May it please the Court. This appeal presents two primary issues. First, when does a violation of the FDCPA occur for the purpose of calculating the one-year statute of limitations period? Appellant respectfully asks this Court to adopt the last opportunity to comply test rather than look to any previous debt collection conduct. At that point, respondents to discrete collection activities at issue in this case each occurred within the FDCPA's one-year statute of limitations. Second, whether respondents' activities occurred in connection with the underlying transaction between appellant and the dentist office. Appellant respectfully suggests that the answer in this case must be in the affirmative, because to show how respondent violated the MMPA necessarily is going to require a comparison to that underlying transaction with the dentist office. Turning first to the FDCPA. It's a strict liability consumer protection statute that allows a consumer to bring a claim, according to 1692KD, within 1 year from the date on which the violation occurs. The majority view of when a violation occurs is at the debt collector's last opportunity to comply with the FDCPA. This theory explains why in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Mattson versus USW Communications found a violation occurred when the debt collector mailed the letter, not when the debtor received it. It is also why in this case, respondent's failure to appear at the trial date and reopening of a debt collection lawsuit were each his last opportunity to comply with the relevant FDCPA provision. For example, consider the reopening of the debt collection lawsuit that he now knew was baseless. First, nothing in the statute allows a look back at earlier conduct to ascertain when this violation occurred. Logically, the violation could not occur months before it had happened, back when the original debt collection lawsuit was filed. No, only when the affirmative step of taking the action to reopen the lawsuit could appellant have had a cause of action under the FDCPA. Nor could sending a demand letter that has a discrepant amount be time barred because of the existence of a previously filed debt collection lawsuit that had already been dismissed. Appellant argues that respondent violated Section 1692 E2A by sending a demand letter that sought a different amount than what was in the debt collection lawsuit. So, in fact, this makes it a different violation by its very nature than what could have been in the debt collection lawsuit itself.
That letter wasn't in the appendix or the file that I saw. Was it, did it refer to the lawsuit? Did it refer to prior demands? What did it say?
Your Honor, I have to admit I don't know exactly what the content of the letter was. I think the relevant issue for appellant's argument would simply be if it asked for a certain dollar figure and that dollar figure does not match the amount in the debt collection lawsuit, whether it referred to it or not, is what would constitute the FDCPA violation. And to the extent that it doesn't refer to it, so long as we pled, and we did, that it's the same debt, that would still make it a discrepant amount. And to the extent that it did refer to the debt collection lawsuit, then that makes the violation all the more easy to prove for an appellant. So either way, we would argue that it's ultimately going to be a violation under 1692 E2A. Appellant also poses this question: what if such a letter was sent 366 days after that debt collection lawsuit had originally been filed? Under respondent's theory, it would theoretically have a zero statute of limitations, that it was barred the instant he had committed the action because, hey, if we look back in time at previous conduct, then it raises the possibility that something that occurred more than a year ago precludes the accrual of a cause of action at the instant the violation actually occurred. This is inconsistent with the text of the statute, which gives a one-year statute of limitations. It's inconsistent with the case law, which says you look to the last opportunity to comply, not the first opportunity to comply. And even if there was such a test, which we argue there should not be, this conduct is not related to the debt collection lawsuit itself, which had been dismissed for failure to prosecute at the time that letter was sent and received. That respondent makes such an argument at all actually itself highlights the problematic nature of such an interpretation. A debt collector can and will claim that any kind of conduct is somehow related back to earlier conduct. In other words, a debt collector could file a lawsuit, hold it, wait a year, and then apparently avoid liability for anything that happened post-petition. The better interpretation, the more logical interpretation, is simply to find that each violation gets its own discrete one-year statute of limitations. Turning to the Merchandising Practices Act, Your Honors. The only question appellant suggests that needs to be answered in this case is whether appellant pled, not proved, a connection between respondent's conduct and the underlying transaction between appellant and the dentist's office. Appellant respectfully submits the answer must be resolved in the affirmative. This court has explained that in connection with means to have a relationship. A relationship exists on these facts because it is necessary to consider the underlying transaction between appellant and the dentist office to show how and why respondent's conduct is actually violative of the MMPA. We can illustrate this principle by looking at the specific allegations. So, appellant alleges that respondent attempted to collect an inflated amount in the debt collection lawsuit, about $458 plus costs plus attorney's fees. But appellant pled that only about $22 could be the maximum amount he could have owed pursuant to his actual agreement with the dentist. So that $22 represents an analysis of the underlying transaction. We can't talk about an inflated amount. We can't talk about respondent's conduct being violative without referencing, talking about, and investigating that underlying transaction. In this way, appellant has met the pleading burden of simply showing a relationship between the alleged conduct and the underlying transaction, namely the dental transaction. Similarly, appellant alleges that respondent used the first date of the dental services from which to run interest on the total balance rather than starting to assess interest from the date of the demand for payment of all those dental services. Again, this violation is not occurring in a vacuum. It requires a look at the original transactions with the dentist to ascertain what date, what was the payment date, what was the demand date, in order to actually assess, was there MMPA violation? Appellant also alleges that respondent relied on a forged and fraudulent contract to assess attorney's fees. Same analysis. It requires an investigation as to the actual dental transaction to determine if respondent knew or should have known the actual details of appellant's agreement with the dentist.
So was the allegation that the, the fraudulent alteration of the contract was done by the debt collector or done by the respondent?
Your Honor, I believe that we actually pled in the alternative on that because, again, this was at an initial pleading stage. You know, we filed a petition. There was a motion to dismiss. I believe the allegation found in the petition was that sometime between when we actually signed and when ultimately we were sued for these attorney's fees, the alteration happened. I do not want to sit here before this august counsel and suggest that a respondent was the one who did that. I have no evidence at this time to suggest it, but somebody did, is what appellant has pled. And it could have been the dentist office itself. It could theoretically have been a debt collection agency. It could have been respondent. The point, however, that we're making is that, again, to decide whether this was a violation, whether that had happened, okay, so is it a violation that respondents should be responsible for? We're going to need to look at the underlying transaction. We're going to need, think of it in terms of discovery. Are we going to need discovery of the underlying transaction in order to make our case under the MMPA? If yes, then it should be in connection with the underlying transaction.
What was the sale of goods or services that you say the fraud here was in connection with?
Your Honor, the answer to that is the sale of the dentist services. That is the transaction that's at question.
In Conway, it wasn't the real estate sale, it was the loan was the good or service being sold. Is that a distinction that matters?
I would respectfully suggest it doesn't change the result in this case, Your Honor. And here's the reasons why. First, we have properly pled that this was in the nature of a loan because of the payment plan that was going to pay for the dentist's services. It wasn't a simple...
If this were an ordinary commercial transaction with a 90-day due date, would you say that that also was a loan?
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense
because
that...
Because it's not immediately due.
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's the position that I'm saying here, that... To the extent that there is any obligations that extend to the future, the first answer is yes. Then it is in the nature of continuing obligations. And to the extent you don't meet those obligations, then that necessarily must be in connection with that transaction if you want to go back and try and collect it. The idea
being, an installment payment agreement, is that right? Or what was it exactly?
I would just classify it as a payment plan, Your Honor, where I can't afford to pay all of my dental bills at this time. Please allow me to make payments over time so that I can get you paid off.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question. You filed a substitute brief in this case after the case was transferred, and every single one of your points alleges error on behalf of the Court of Appeals. It doesn't attack or allege any error of the Circuit Court's judgment. So how are any of your arguments preserved?
Your Honor, the substance of each of these, the exception perhaps of the standard of review, addresses exactly what the trial court did, is the same arguments that were made to the Court of Appeals. The substance of the arguments are identical. We simply use the Court of Appeals decision as the basis of...
Yeah, I understand that. Our rules are to say if you file a substitute brief, that we're to rely on those and that you've abandoned the arguments you made in the Court of Appeals.
All I can say, Your Honor, is even still, the arguments that we present in terms of the what is the correct standard for when a FDCPA cause of action, when the violation occurs, was the issue with the trial court, Court of Appeals, and here, Your Honor, the same thing goes. The trial court dismissed it because they said the MMPA, this was not in connection with. That's the issue that was briefed before the Court of Appeals. The arguments in terms of why we think that it is in connection with are the same arguments that we present to this court. In terms of Conway as well, Your Honor, I wanted to point out that this type of relationship, in terms of the looking back, explains the disparate results in Watson and Conway. In Conway, you have to look at the underlying mortgage agreement to see if City Mortgage had sent the notice to the wrong address, to see if it had not properly applied the escrow payments in accordance with the documents. In Watson, though, where it wasn't found to be in connection with, it's because there was a separate second agreement. You don't have to look at the underlying mortgage document to see did something happen wrong here. That is unlike our case. So our point is to get to an in connection with, that's all you need to do. To paraphrase Ports Petroleum of Ohio versus Nixon, for better or worse, the literal words cover every relationship imaginable to whatever degree. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. I'd like to first start with the MMPA argument, if you don't mind. What we're really here to talk about is the scope. And under Conway, the appellant is basically arguing that Conway and Watson opens the door to basically holding all third-party collectors accountable under the MMPA. But my reading of Conway and Watson is far more narrow than that. And I believe you took a lot of time and effort to explain why it's more narrow than that. First of all, in Conway, you took the time to understand, to address what's in connection with me. You said in connection with is to be in connect, to have a connection, to have a relationship. But unlike what Pellin is arguing, it's not just any relationship. It's not some peripheral relationship. It's a meaningful relationship and one that is intricate to the underlying transaction. For example, you talked about sale and what the definition of sale is. And the sale, in the context of a loan, is a bundle of services. And they talked about how a loan processor is liable under the MMPA because under that bundle of services, it has a very strong connection with both the lender and the borrower. It is dealing with the transaction, is carrying out the transaction that was purchased, which is why it's part of the sale. It's an intimate relationship with both the lender and the borrower. That is far different than what is pleaded in this case. And I understand we're going by with the pleadings, and I'm taking the pleadings as true for the purposes of this oral argument. What's pleaded is that we have a sale of dental services. It's pleaded that there were four times that the dental services were provided, and they ended, I believe, in April 2012. Well, the collection action didn't start until September of 2013, so about a year and a half later. But we had four dental services over, I think, a four-month period of time, and then the services were over. Okay? Now, they claim that there was a payment plan, but what's actually pleaded is that they were given a credit and allowed to pay over time. There's no payment plan articulated. There's no loan articulated.
Well, why do they owe you money?
Say again, please.
Why are you saying they owed money on the debt? Because they had agreed to pay it for those services?
For the services, that's correct.
And so you're collecting on the debt they owed for the services?
That's correct.
So why is that not in connection with the sale of the services?
The reason I don't believe it's in connection with the sale of the services, and in Conway and Watson, you talked about the sale, I mean, it has a peripheral relationship. I mean, it has a but-for relationship.
I mean, the statute says before, during, or after. Since it can be after the sale, it necessarily includes something other than what happens at the time of the sale.
I agree with that. But again, after the sale, I don't believe that the statute intended, or at least the way I'm reading of Conway and Watson, intended it for be any relationship, but one that had a meaningful relationship when it's a third party.
And where do you get all that from the statute, which says before, during, or after, in connection with the sale, before, during, or after the sale?
I understand. I look at Gibson, for example. Gibson is a case that was, the Shookman case, I believe, was after. It was about a warranty, correct? But that warranty was one that was sold by the seller. It wasn't a third party that was being held liable for a future, we'll call it violation, or a future misrepresentation of the lifetime warranty. Here, again,
tell me where I'm misunderstanding. In Conway, I believe it was, we said it was in connection with the sale where you were collecting on a debt after the sale. Watson, we said it was not because it was not a service, because the alleged fraud had to do with modification and a new loan, and we said that was not a service. The lender agreed to sell or the borrower agreed to buy when the parties agreed to the loan. They were not attempting to enforce the terms of the loan, but rather contemplating a new agreement and allegedly committed fraud in regard to that. Here, they're suing because they said you're committing fraud correctly or incorrectly in connection with the terms of the initial loan, the initial agreement to delay payment for services.
I guess the biggest thing I can say to distinguish it or to say why I don't believe the collection action is in connection with for the purposes of the MMPA is, as you stated in Conway's, because each party must continue to perform these services under a long-term relationship and a loan, the sale continues throughout the time the parties perform their services. Well, in this case, the services are over. The dental services have been over for a year and a half. Mr. Jackson didn't pay. I mean, it's over. When I come into this...
Well, in the other cases, they got the loan, and they got the product. They're just having to pay later, too.
Well, okay. Again, I guess maybe the difference is I argue that that is a more peripheral relationship than is intended by the statute, or at least was intended by this court in my reading of Conway and Watson.
I'm sorry, go ahead. We're here on a motion to dismiss, right?
That is correct.
And unlike the first count under the FDCPA, that was converted to a summary judgment, but we're here just on a motion to dismiss.
That is correct, Your Honor. But even taking the facts as true, taking the timeline that they've pleaded as true, taking my involvement, which was nothing at all during the before the transaction or during the transaction, taking even that as true, I believe the law, as articulated in Conway and Watson, would not have the collection action as being susceptible or falling under the MMPA.
Counsel, neither the trial court resolved both under a motion to dismiss. It was the Court of Appeals that appeared to turn the first issue into summary judgment, wasn't it? Because I'm looking at the order of judgment, and it says defendant's motion to dismiss is called, heard, and granted.
I agree. The motion there was a motion to dismiss in the trial court.
On both counts one and count two. Right.
I did see that the Eastern District, as to the MMPA count, did apply a motion to dismiss standard. As to the FDCPA count, it sounded like they were applying it as summary judgment.
But doesn't our cases clearly say we take the judge at his word, right, her word. And this court, the underlying judgment clearly was on the motion to dismiss and didn't consider anything outside the pleadings.
That is correct, Your Honor. One thing that may have happened in the Eastern District is that...
That disappeared, so it
doesn't matter. Yeah, and that point two of the appeal talked about the Eastern District standard, which was something I think we've already kind of hit on, that we're at you're looking at the trial court.
Can you tell me about this July letter that was sent after that case was dismissed? Who was it sent to?
Well, my recollection is it wasn't a letter, but I forget how it was exactly pleaded, but it was a demand. It was a settlement demand. It was
made upon who?
By sent my office onto the Mr. Jackson's defense attorney at that time.
So yes. It was sent to counsel, not to the consumer.
That is correct.
After the case was dismissed.
It was after the case was dismissed and on the same day that we had filed a motion to vacate, which
but
was
it was
six
sent
days.
To counsel and not sent to the underlying client.
That is correct.
Okay. And is there anything in the record to explain why an entirely new number was used that had not been used in the suit?
Well, the petition asked for $458.52 plus attorney's fees, interest, and court costs. The demand would have incorporated the principal amount plus the court costs that had amassed at that time plus interest. So that would have explained why that's a higher amount, which are the same types of charges that were asked for in the initial collection action pleading. In fact, you can tell us paragraph 61 of the First Amendment petition in this case, the appellate even alleges that as of the date of the petition, plaintiff is, well, they say that I was actively pursuing throughout the time of that litigation the $458.52 together with interest, reasonable attorney's fees, and court costs. I mean, even they understood that the collection action, both the petition itself and the ongoing settlement efforts and everything else, tied back to the amount sought in the petition. Even in their own First Amendment petition, they seem to understand it all ties back to the collection action, which is why under the majority of the law out there, the only two circuits that have actually addressed this issue, when you have an ongoing litigation and you have reassertions or later effects of the petition that was filed out of time, are those separate events or are they tied back to the out of time petition? And they all say it's tied back to the out of time petition. That's the Slorp case, CalGov, and Schaffheiser. Schaffheiser's the third district.
Let me go back to the motion to dismiss the FDPCA.
Yes.
You attached to your motion documents that were not attached to or incorporated into the petition, correct?
I did.
And there was discussion in the motion and the response raising undisputed, but albeit collateral facts not pled in the petition. So how are we to review this under the summary judgment like approach, given that nobody objected to considering facts towards the pleadings, which is what the Court of Appeals did, or should we ignore everything but the pleadings and review it as a motion to dismiss?
I believe motion to dismiss is the proper standard, and here's why. The only documents presented by me at the motion to dismiss, for the motion to dismiss hearing, were pleadings and documents already filed in court in the collection action. In full candor of the court, I can't remember the Missouri. I know that the federal law allows that, and they don't treat that as outside of the pleadings. They consider documents that are filed in other cases as being not outside the pleadings, but inside and okay for the motion to dismiss. And honestly, I can't remember what the standard is for Missouri courts. If Missouri courts follow that same philosophy, however, then there wasn't anything technically outside of the pleadings for the purposes of a motion to dismiss. The motion to dismiss standard was still proper. And that, I don't believe, was even raised on appeal. That may have been raised now at the Supreme Court level, but that wasn't raised on appeal.
Do we have cases that state that if the trial court, even if you file documents and we were to consider them as going beyond what you should file with a motion to dismiss, and so the court could have converted it to summary judgment, where it did not, and it ruled on the motion to dismiss, on appeal we review it as a motion to dismiss.
I'm sorry. What
too
was
complex. That? Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I don't have a case that directly talks about that issue. No.
Okay.
I will say though, I don't believe that was an issue properly defined in the Eastern District. In a later, they talk about the Eastern District using the wrong standard, but I don't believe that was. That issue is before this court, or was before before even the Eastern District. Okay, going back to the FD, I guess now we'll switch over real quick to the FDCPA. We talked about the letter. I think we covered that. It's the same thing, you know. And regarding the no-show, the original had a calendaring error. The trial court, the collection action trial court, recognized that and granted my motion to vacate the dismissal for lack of prosecution. They recognized it was a good faith mistake not to show up at trial, incredibly embarrassing, especially now discussing it in front of the Supreme Court. But it was just that, and there was no intent behind it, as found as a matter of law by the collection act, by the collection actions court. Even if the appellant is to say, well, it doesn't matter, it wasn't intentional, it's still a violation. It's difficult to argue that not going to trial is an attempt to collect the debt. In fact, just the opposite. Not showing up, as embarrassing as it was also not an attempt to collect the debt, because I wasn't
there
to
do so. Well, you
know
what he's referring to, that you keep continuing something till the other side doesn't show up, and then you take a judgment, and that is a tactic that some people use in the trial courts, and that's what he was suggesting.
I would never use that tactic. No, I did not use that tactic, and that's in fact, if, you know what, and that's a good point, actually. The trial court found I didn't use that tactic, because if the trial court thought I didn't use that tactic,
right,
it would have said otherwise.
The court found that it was a good faith mistake.
That's correct. And that ruling, by the way, was not taken under appeal, they didn't file a motion to reconsider, so that should be taken as true for the purposes of evaluating that. And then the last point about reinstating the case being a violation, they cite the Golowski case, which is a Northern District of Illinois case, which is the only case that I know of in the country in any state or federal level. And even that case was radically different. It was a case that reinstated collection firm tried to reinstate a case after 2 years or that they originally dismissed pursuant to a settlement plan and then tried to reopen it in the wrong venue. And I think the Eastern District and even the trial court properly noticed the radical differences in the facts to not really have that be a persuasive case or meaningful for the evaluation of this claim. The last thing I do want to talk about is they never brought up equitable tolling at the trial court level. They do bring it up now, though, and that argument should be considered abandoned as it was never presented, as well as they claim that the trial court should not have dismissed with prejudice but without. And again, not only was that not introduced in front of the Eastern District, it wasn't even introduced in the original substitution brief. It was only introduced in the substitution reply brief, meaning that I think that is well abandoned. And even then, if you don't consider it abandoned, the cases to which they cite both say that a court has a discretion, and the cases to which they cite say that those courts did dismiss with prejudice, were okay to do so. And this is the First Amendment petition as it was. So thank you for your time very much.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, did you have questions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. As a common sense matter, to a layperson, the collection of a debt is in connection with the purchase of merchandise that gave rise to that debt. Every other term in section 407.020, subsection 1, is defined, except for these three words, in connection with. That's why this court has said, absent a statutory definition, consider the plain and ordinary meaning of the words themselves, which in this case are unrestricted, all-encompassing, and exceedingly broad.
To whom was the debt owed during this collection? I profess ignorance. Had this debt been sold, or was it still at least nominally in the name of the dentist?
To the best of our knowledge, Your Honor, it was never sold. It was still owed to the dentist at all times. With that said, I have to confess again, we were at the initial pleading stage. We had filed a petition. There was a motion to dismiss. There was no opportunity to dig deeper into to be able to give you a definitive answer to your question.
No, that's. I just wonder why not sue the dentist for the acts of his or her agents, employees, representatives, rather than sue the agent?
This is what I'll say to that, Your Honor. We did, and those defendants have been dismissed without prejudice. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor. But I don't know that it would, even had we not sued, the question I think here is, did we have the right to go after the attorney that was causing the ascertainable loss, namely the need to go defend ourselves at a lawsuit? I think the answer to that question ultimately is yes here. And I want to clarify, we're not suggesting a but-for causation. Yeah, but for a transaction, you wouldn't have collected the debt. What we're suggesting, though, is that for two reasons at least, some debt collectors are going to be responsible under the MMPA, right? First, you still have to have an ascertainable loss. There still has to be that kind of out-of-pocket loss. And that happened here. We had to defend ourselves at a lawsuit, had to pay for counsel. Second, it still is going to have to allege some facts that require a look back at the underlying transaction. So in this case, for example, we had to look at what was the real agreement with the dentist, what really happened. one could imagine a debt collector, a debt collection attorney, who did something that wouldn't necessarily require a look back. For example, harassing phone calls. Don't necessarily need to look at the underlying dental transaction to decide if those were harassing. So in this case in particular, under these specific facts, I think we can find that the actions of the debt collection attorney meets the definition of in connection with and was properly sued under the Merchandising Practices Act, Your Honor. The alternative result, by the way, would simply create a new whole cloth exemption not found in the statute. We know how to create exemptions to this statute. We certainly know how to amend the statute. They've proven that lately. So all they chose not to have this exemption for debt collectors, and we'd ask this court not to create one out of the case law. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate it.
Case will be submitted.